And so for today we're going to be rounding off the story. Actually, last week I kind of mentioned this. I mean, kind of a little surprise to know that I wasn't entirely sure what I was going to be doing. But I had an idea that we would be creating our own myth in this session. But to be honest, I kind of couldn't figure out how to do it. Maybe there isn't time or something. But anyway, look, we're not necessarily going to be doing that tonight, but let's see how we go for time and so on. But I do hope that this evening's talk is going to be a little bit more spacious and give a little bit more time for questions and feedback, because I'm conscious that in the last few weeks we've been quite a lot of content to present. Okay, so as with all of the sessions, I'd like to begin by telling a story. And the story of this week is another one from the Jatakas, and this is the story of the little stick collector, the Katahari Jataka, one of my favourites. This is Jataka number 7. I'm going to be reading it from the version which I have for my book. So this book here, White Bones, Red Rock, Black Snakes, which you should, all of the stuff that I've been talking about in this course, if you want to go further into it and explore it, all of that stuff and a lot more is all in here. So this is a slightly refined version of this translation. So this is Katahari Jataka, Jataka number 7. King Brahmadatta of Benares, with a magnificent retinue, was wandering through a park desirous of fruits and flowers, and he saw a certain maiden singing while gathering branches. Filled with desire, they consummated the act of love. She immediately felt her belly become heavy as if filled with the thunderbolt of Indra. She told the king that she was bearing his child. The king gave her the ring as a token of parentage and instructed her to spend the ring on the upbringing if the child was a girl. Then if it turned out to be a son, to bring the infant to the king together with the ring. Then he left. Great parenting skills there, then. Now, the child was indeed a boy who was brought up by his mother. When he was playing, the other children would tease him, saying, "No father has hit me." So he went to his mother and asked who his father was. She told him the whole story, upon which he begged to be taken to the king. Seeing her child's determination, she took him to the gate of the palace and had their coming announced to the king. They were summoned within. She entered, bowed to the king, and said, "Your Highness, this is your son." But the king was ashamed before his court, and so he denied his own son. When she produced the signet ring as proof, he said, "This is not my ring." The mother boldly addressed him, "O king, I have no witness except for the truth. If this child be your son, may he remain in midair. If not, may he fall to the ground and die." She took the child by the foot and tossed him into the air. The wonderful child, who was of course the Bodhisattva, sat cross-legged in midair and sang in sweet tones, "Great king, I am your son. You should rear me, protector of the people. The king rears others, still more he should look after his own child." When the king heard the Dhamma thus taught, he cried out, "Come, my child." And he stretched out his hand, saying, "I myself shall rear you. I shall myself shall rear you." And though 1,000 hands were stretched out to save the boy, he descended into the king's hands and sat in his lap. The king made the child the crown prince, and the mother became the chief queen. So this is a to me very, very powerful and very beautiful little myth in miniature. And I'm not going to talk about all of the details of this story, but this was one of the first Jatakas that I read when I was studying this topic that made me realize that a lot of these very ancient kind of mythic motifs could be found in these stories. I want to go into, it's a very, very rich text and very rich story on many levels. but I won't go into too much detail, but I'll just notice the position of the two main characters, you know, the little stick collector who, you know, I mean, has nothing, right? I mean, she's just a little girl or a maiden, young woman, wandering around collecting sticks, you know? And she's in nature, right? In the forest, part of nature. And singing. I mean, it's quite a charming image, right? You know, maybe she was collecting firewood for the cooking stove or something like that. And so when the king comes along, the king is the visitor to nature. Right? He comes from outside. So the king is a representative here of culture. Right? The king lives in a palace, not in a forest. And when that event is very reminiscent of many of the, if you're familiar with many of the Greek myths, where Zeus was, and various others, but mainly Zeus, were going around and impregnating various nymphs and so on in different places. And of course it's clear from the story itself that this, that there's something more than human going on here, right? I mean, she immediately felt her belly become heavy as if filled with the thunderbolt of Indra. Right? I mean, she knew that she was pregnant right away. So this isn't to sort of describing just an ordinary sort of human act of love, but this is describing something which is has some spiritual dimension to it. And you may also notice the judging of the child, the suspension of the child, is like what's known as the Caucasian chalk circle, which was one of the plays by Bertolt Brecht. And that story, more closely to the Brechtian version, is actually found in one of the Jatakas as well, the old Indian tale. But the Bodhisattva in that story ends up suspended in midair, not to touch the ground, not to see the sky, in between all, suspended between the mother and the father. Okay? Not part of one or part of the other. So I'll leave this story there for now, and we may come back to it later. But the main topic for this evening is the topic of creative mythology. And I'm going to briefly recap the ground that we've travelled so far. In the first section, we covered the basics of mythology and looking at what they were and how they worked, and some of the basic points there. Myth is a sacred story. Myth is told by a people, not by a person. So it has a communal or a universal aspect to it. The great topic of myth is about the death of God, or alternatively, about the arising of consciousness. Historically, the oldest myth that we have comes from before about 500 BCE, and it can be recognized by various archaic motifs, many of some of which we have discussed through the course. And younger myth, that is myth that comes from after that time, is self-aware. So the older myth has a quality of being spontaneous, organic. This younger myth has more the quality of being consciously constructed. People knew what are the tropes of myths. How do you put together a story? And they put together those stories. In the second session, we looked at the suttas, and we saw that there are occasional fragments of older myths which are found in the suttas. We looked at a few cases of those. We looked at the Pali Jataka collection, the world's oldest, largest, and most complete source of ancient story. It's important to remember that not all Jatakas include old mythology, but some of them do. And we contrasted a fable which sets up a relatively straightforward black and white morality. This is right, this is wrong, and it's a story that has a conclusion and has a lesson to it. Whereas mythology tends to have an ambiguous moral. And within the Buddhist tradition, the most important example of that is the choice made by Siddhartha on the evening of his going forth. Right? The choice to leave his wife and his children, his son behind, and to go and seek enlightenment. And this is an ambiguous morality because there's a conflict, an irreducible conflict between his duties as a father and as a husband to look after his family and his own spiritual needs to seek enlightenment. And so that's an example of how in mythology it presents these ambiguous sets of values, and that the purpose of it is to provoke wonder and to ask us to question our own values and to ask, what is the right thing to do? Not to give us an answer that says, oh yes, you know, this is right and this is wrong. So again, this is not to say that one of these forms of stories is better than the other. It's just to say that they're different kinds of stories that form different purposes.
And then, so wouldn't you say it's more of a statement? Like, you know, going back to the story of the Buddha leaving his family for the forest, isn't he making a statement in that where he leaves because he's putting the spiritual life above the lay life?
In terms of the Siddhartha's choice, yes, he's making the choice about what his value is, but then when we look at it, it's still problematic, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, if somebody was to come to me, you know, and somebody who had a family, and say, you know, should I become a monk and just walk out and leave my family behind? Right? And so the tradition wrestles with that. And so this is why in the telling of that story, every time that it's told slightly differently. Mm. And so the tradition sort of says all the different ways of negotiating around that particular nexus, because it's irreducible at the end of the day. How can you say that it's right for the Buddha to leave his wife and kid behind? Right? Well, the Siddhartha at the time. But on the other hand, if he didn't, then we wouldn't have Buddhism, we wouldn't have the Dhamma. But you're quite right, like within an individual can make that choice, you know, which may be the right choice for them, but the purpose of the story is to preserve the ambiguity. Okay. So the third session last week, we looked at the role in particular of gendered qualities in stories, the way that stories tend to associate gender with particular qualities. And I posited that these qualities are not within the story, are not static, but are part of a character's growth. And that is to say it's not that male qualities are better, female qualities are better or worse or anything like that, but that there are qualities associated with men and women which are part of the character growth, and the growth of men and women depend on each other. That these qualities are in the higher forms of myth especially, are seen to be something that reaches a balance. And the most characteristic of these stories is the Dolhala story, the story of a woman's pregnancy cravings, or the craving or irreducible and irrational desire. And we saw lower forms of this with the crocodile and the monkey. We saw middle forms of it with the outcast breaking into the king's garden. And we saw the higher forms with the golden peacock and the golden deer. And in the higher forms of that story, the woman's desire leads to compassion and abundance. And her essential quality in that story is stillness. And I suggested that this story is a feminine counterpart to the hero myth. So whereas the hero leaves the home, like Siddhartha, travels into the wilderness, into the unknown, encounters obstacles, monsters, enemies, and so on, vanquishes them out there, and then eventually wins a prize, returns home with the prize. That's the hero's story. Feminine counterpart, she stays home. And the monsters are the monsters she finds in the home. And so her journey is that journey of stillness rather than a journey of movement. So this was from last week. Any thoughts or questions or comments on that before we move on? brief recap of the last sessions. Okay, so this week I want to look at creative mythology, which essentially is what we do when we inherited these stories and ideas and so on, and then how we what we make of them. So people shape new stories knowingly using the tropes of old myth. I would say that the earliest creative mythology in the West is probably Homer's Odyssey. And if you look at the Odyssey as compared to the Iliad is earlier. And the Iliad has a much more straightforward narrative structure. Basically tells a kind of linear story of the events when the Greek forces went to Troy. Whereas the Odyssey has a very sophisticated literary structure where Odysseus is on his way home and his wife Penelope is in the home and she's doing her weaving. She has her whole kind of story, which is similar to the Dogla story. She has to overcome the monsters in her home, right, who are the suitors who want to marry her and get all of her money. And she has to do that. She does that by weaving during the daytime and unpicking all her weaving at night. And telling them, oh yes, well, we'll get the marriage done when the weaving's finished. Yeah? And so she has to use her ingenuity and her persistence and so on to overcome those obstacles in the home, while Odysseus is on his journey, his hero's journey, trying to find his way home and going through, of course, many different events. And so it has a very sophisticated literary structure, which I think is created by a great literary mind rather than being something which is just an inheritance from an oral storytelling tradition. In the Asian context, I would say that the new myth, or the young myth, really begins with the life of the Buddha. And the life of the Buddha also has those signs, in a different way, of being something which is consciously created by people who knew and understood about how the tropes of storytelling work. I'm not going to discuss the life of the Buddha in much detail, but just briefly to recap how it is formed. Presumably, it begins with various anecdotes told by the Buddha himself, right? So the Buddha said, you know, he was, you know, mentioned that he taught the Dhammacakka Sutta in the Dhyapada Benares, or gives a story about his struggles with meditation under his former teachers and so on. So there are various anecdotes about the Buddha's life which the Buddha himself told. Having said which, the Buddha didn't seem to be that interested in himself, to be honest. Like, he didn't tell a lot of stories about his own sort of life all that much. He was more interested in teaching the Dhamma. So there's a few personal stories, but interestingly, you know, not all that much. When I teach Dhamma, I'm sort of conscious of this because people, you know, in a way, people like to hear personal stories. And so, you know, if you begin with telling what your personal story is, it's a very nice way to connect with people. But I always remember when I was a young monk at Wat Nanachant, and I was talking about this in front of the other monks, and he'd given a talk in England at the Buddhist Society there, and he went there and he gave a talk on some Dhamma topic. And after he gave the talk, somebody came up to him and said, oh, thank goodness, I just wanted to thank you so much. You're the first monk who's ever come here who hasn't just told us about their story of how they became a monk. And you actually talked about the Dhamma. So, I mean, there's a role for personal stories and so on, but it's not about me. So, you know, I tell a story, a personal story from time to time, but I think, you know, the Buddha was mostly concerned with teaching Dhamma. Other stories get more loosely passed down in the community, right? So, you know, they might repeat a teaching and then, you know, they might sort of mention the background to that thing or and so on. So the background narratives of stories, the particular occasion for that teaching was remembered somewhat loosely in the tradition. And then after the Buddha passed away, it was shaped into a more coherent story with suttas, where you have suttas that usually have a simple narrative background, telling a discrete event in the life of the Buddha, but also the beginnings of more ambitious narratives, particularly the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, where you're approaching the length of a short novel. So these texts are starting to develop quite a degree of literary sophistication. And I believe that it's appropriate to credit Venerable Ananda with that. He was the one who was first introduced that literary form of those stories. And in the life of the Buddha, one of the most remarkable details about it is that if the subtext of myth is the dawning of consciousness, and this is certainly according to Jung is the theme of mythology, is the real hero's journey is trying to find themselves. That's actually what they're doing. And in the Buddha's story, that's like right on the surface, right? It's not a metaphor or anything. I mean, it's the story of somebody who's seeking enlightenment. So as time went on, I mean, there's only so many times you can tell the life of the Buddha, right? But you got to dress it up. This is one of the things in the traditions, right? You've got to keep things entertaining, right? You've got to have new stories to tell. And so that life of the Buddha was extended into the past through the device of adopting Jataka tales. And so giving the Jataka tales a framework, integrating them with stories from the time of the Buddha. And so eventually all heroes are the Bodhisattva. And this is actually said in the commentary somewhere that the hero of every story, in fact, is the Bodhisattva in his past life. So, and the mythology in the life of the Buddha didn't cease with the Buddha's death, but was extended after his death, originally with the account of the Second Council, 100 years after the Buddha, which tells of events and developments in the Sangha there, and then in later times to the various sectarian mythologies, which tell of how the Buddha established the Dhamma and how it then became established in these particular regions or these particular sects of Buddhism. So the best known of those secular mythologies is from Sri Lanka with the Dipavansa or Mahavansa, where you have essentially a mythological tale in the origin of it, but then from a couple of hundred years after the Buddha, the story becomes essentially a history. Right? So the origin of it is in mythology with all of the mythic motifs that we've noticed before, and then it becomes essentially an account of history. And there are other sectarian mythologies from the different schools of Buddhism and so on, telling of how the Buddha foretold Dhamma would go to their particular area and so on and so forth. So this is the way that the different schools of Buddhism would find some kind of connection with the time of the Buddha through telling stories about that. Now, one of the, to me, very important, very kind of memorable insights about mythology was from a book called The Marriage of Cadmus and Harmony, which I borrowed from Giles. Thanks, Giles. I think I borrowed it from your place for like 6 years or something.
Yeah, it's a long time.
And by Roberto Colasso. Fantastic book. And He kind of suggests what actually might be the point of his book, like in the last sentence of it, and sort of suggests it in passing. But in the story is of how Zeus, there was a prophecy that Zeus would die. Right? Remember this idea that in one way or another, mythology is always about the death of God. So how is Zeus going to die? One of his sons would kill him, and of course Zeus was, you know, a bit of a lad. So he had lots of sons all over the place. So which one is going to be the one that's going to kill him, right? And the suggestion was that it was ultimately Cadmus. Cadmus was the hero who was attributed with the introduction of letters into the cultural sphere in Europe. So the idea is that who is going to... No longer do we encounter God in nature, in the spirit, in the life, but we read about God in books, and we've reduced him and we've imprisoned him. Right? And the story in the little stick collector, right? She encounters God in a very memorable way, right? And it's an experience. It's a happening. It's a life-changing event. Right? And this, whether you consider it as metaphor, or you consider it as a real thing, or whatever you consider it as, it's something which is a life-changing, dramatic, powerful experience. And those, that kind of language and that kind of way of talking about encounters with God is very, very common in the ancient world. So then whatever happens, you know, we come down from, Moses comes down from the mountaintop with the Ten Commandments on his stone slabs. Moses goes up to the mountaintop and sees God up there. We don't have to do that anymore. We just read what it says on the stone slabs. So God becomes redundant. And if God comes along later on and says, yeah, no, 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 there was a typo in that one. It wasn't really what I meant. Say, no, 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 this is what it says in the book. Right? And so the experience of God becomes dismissed in favor of the received knowledge of God. And because artifacts like this remain constant through time, more or less, then you have a way, you start to have a way that you can actually look at what were the facts in the past. And you start to be able to distinguish between what is the reality and what is the story about the reality. These are kinds of distinctions which was impossible to make before. And so the writing, writing was more influential in the European sphere than in the Indian sphere, that's true. But at the same time, you still see that same kind of thing where there's the mythology was before you could conceive of a distinction between fiction and history. And then later on, both of those two things emerged from mythology. Okay. Any questions on that?
With that writing thing, which difference between Europe and India, I think it was Mark Allen who said that there's evidence that writing in India was actually quite early, but in the religious sphere, they deliberately chose not to use the written word. Is that your understanding? I vaguely remember something like that.
Right, yeah. I'm
just wondering if that's the reason is because they didn't want to pin these things down like this.
Exactly, right? Exactly. I mean, yes, I think that is likely to be the case. It's an area that there really isn't a huge amount of direct evidence, but I think it's certainly a plausible understanding. And you can imagine, right, that if, say, if you're in a monastery or something, and, you know, all that you'd ever done and all you'd ever known was that the monks and the nuns would memorize all the suttas and recite them and things, use that for your meditation and, you know, come together and recite them for your chanting. And then somebody comes along and says, guys, you just write it down. And you just have to write it down once. Everyone would be like, oh, come on, get out of here. You know, this is the death of Buddhism, right? This is the end of the thing, right? Because you no longer actually have to know it in your heart. You can externalize it and you can just put it in a book. Right? So this is, you know, you can imagine that surely there must have been a big kind of... it's interesting, like, that in the Indian tradition, from King Ashoka and so on, shows writing from, whatever, 150, 200 years after the Buddha, but fairly small amounts, right, not whole religious texts. So we don't have actual full religious texts until later than that. And I think the Hindu tradition is later still. Like, the Buddhist tradition would have been the innovator, that we were the ones who actually introduced it. We would have been the ones who developed the technology to make it possible. But, you know, it's still an ongoing process. I mean, the oral tradition is still important within Buddhism.
Wasn't it the case that those early writings were reserved for the wealthy only, and that the general people never really got to see or experience them in any way, because they were all handwritten? It was only when printing came along that the masses got...
Yeah, look, I mean, it seems reasonable, yes. Again, it's hard to say because there's an absence of evidence in the Indian sphere, but look, it seems reasonable and certainly was expensive to do the writing, that's for sure. Labor intensive, you know, the material preparation was difficult.
Excuse me, but they have father just go the Bhagavad Gita.
So Bhagavad Gita, an expert on the chronology of Hindu texts, typically I think if you'd ask a scholar, they'd probably say that there are estimates between 500 BC and 500 AD or later.
After the Buddha.
Or before.
So there are more ancient Mahabharata, which is very ancient.
Well, Bhagavad Gita is part of Mahabharata.
Oh, I'm thinking the Rig Veda then.
You're thinking the Rig Veda, right? So Rig Veda is definitely earlier. Yeah. Probably the Mahabharata existed in some form before the Buddha, but wasn't put in the form that we have today. One of the interesting things, which I haven't gone into in a lot of detail, is that in the Jatakas, there are excerpts and incidents from the Mahabharata and from the Ramayana, which are probably the earliest form of that story. Yeah. So the most likely, you know, there was that oral tradition. I mean, in the suttas it doesn't mention Mahabharata explicitly, but it does mention like the Itihasa, the like legendary tales and so on. So presumably the stories were there, and then they were put into a literary form somewhat later on. And you know, that role was by Valmiki to do the Ramayana, and, you know, similar to what Homer did in the sense of kind of inheriting the oral tradition and then shaping it into a literary form. But Mahabharata is interesting because a lot of the cultural assumptions and information in Mahabharata is actually quite archaic, but the literary form of it is somewhat late.
So you would not call that creative mythology?
I would, yes.
But Ramayana would be before the Buddha.
The origins of the story, yes, but the exact form that it's in put by Valmiki was probably later.
So you think it is not the earliest one for creative mythology?
It would have been an early one, for sure. Yeah. But like I said, I mean, there's an earlier version of the Ramayana in the Jatakas, it's interesting, right? I mean, it's fascinating to see if it's got a short version of that story. It doesn't have the whole thing, but it does have quite a, you know, it's very distinctive. It's definitely that story, right? It's not just a related story that has some similar themes, you know, it's a version of that story. So, yeah, but this is the thing with Indian texts in general, it's so hard to date things. And the reality is that almost all of them, with the exception of things that were actually, treaties and poems composed by a person, most of them, they in fact were composed over a long period of time. They don't really have a composition date.
So, I'd love to add two things. I mean, you know, listening to the myths, I keep reframing them in a post-feminist modern way. You go back to that first story, the sick lady, and because it's also, you find it in the sutras about the warnings to women and being in forests. So, you know, the assault of women would have been fairly regular, if you like. Unfortunately. And so his protection of his lineage, if you said, you know, and you know, the behaviour of men of influence throughout history has always been fairly prolific. So, you know, and it's documented in different cultures. And
yeah, sure, sure.
So in terms of that patriarchal advantage, and so that kind of rescues that, because in any other story, the child's going to be disowned and he's going to have stones thrown at. And the second part is...
I mean, so sorry to come back, but that is interesting, and all of those things are there. I mean, obviously it's an uncomfortable power relationship that they have, right?
Yeah.
And that same story can be, depending on how it's told, right? I mean, often, especially in the Greek myths, it's just told as a rape.
Yeah.
You know, it's not even try to hide it. In that one, it's not told in that way.
Yeah.
Where the Buddhists tend to tell their stories in a bit more of a gentle way.
Yeah.
So...
And you add the supernatural, which then leads to the bath,
right?
The child being able to being spiritual in that sense.
Yeah.
So the second one, is the Buddha a myth? And the story of enlightenment.
Well, in the
sorry, but
in the first lesson,
yeah.
I made the emphatic point that when we talk about mythology in this course, we're not talking about what is true and what is not true.
Right.
That's a question for historians. So the story of mythology is to understand what does a story mean, not is a story true. Yeah? So the Buddha's story is certainly a myth in the sense of being a story that has a meaning and a sacred meaning for a people. In that sense, definitely it's a myth. To what extent it's historically true or not? Yeah. I mean, I you know, touched on that in the sort of summary of the life of the Buddha. I think that you know many of the anecdotes and details told within the life of the Buddha probably represent what happened to him. But of course, a lot of the details and so on were added later. Yeah.
I mean, what I do like about the story of the Buddha is it's a story of enlightenment, you know, a spiritual path and enlightenment that I haven't found in any other kind of writings, you know.
Any other questions? Oh, yeah.
A lot of what we're talking about here seems to get tied up with chronology of events when things happened.
Okay.
Did they have a, before the modern era began, did they have a system of dating things in chronology? And what was the beginning? Where did they start?
Oh, cranky. Well, in India, loosely it was based, the chronology was loosely based on the lineages. Okay, so the royal lineages, and then later in the Sangha, and in the Brahmins would be teaching lineages, and also that also became something in Buddhism as well. So the oldest lineages were the lunar lineage and the solar lineage, the Ikshvaku family being the ancestor of the solar lineage. And so these go back in time, right? And so again, at a certain point, then these become records of historical kings, right? But they also disappear into the mists of history. So the dates and so on would tend to be reckoned by the years within the reign of a king, and that reign of that king would tend to be reckoned by his place within that lineage. And so it's as unsatisfactory as it sounds. For one reason, it's really hard to date things. Yeah, it's completely like in China, it's completely different. So once everything goes to China, you've got dates for everything. So we actually date a lot of Buddhist texts from the time that they went to China, because they were like really good at recording their dates. But in India, they didn't for whatever reason. So yeah, I mean the best, and again, for whatever accidental reason, the best historical texts from the Indian cultural sphere are in Sri Lanka. And so we have like the dates of Sri Lankan history from about some of Ashoka or a bit after are known with a high degree of confidence. But in India, nothing. I mean, there's something, but it's weird.
Different groups of people, different religions, where they have their own chronologies and they never shed the twain shall meet.
They had their own, no, not quite. That would be too easy. They had their own chronologies, which kind of interrelated and connected with each other in weird and not always consistent ways.
Could have anything to do with the fact that Buddhism was eventually wiped out by the Muslims and they came through?
It could be. It's hard to say. I mean, it seems likely that most of the Buddhist literature, at least, you know, was actually already taken to Tibet and China and translated.
Okay.
I mean, obviously things were lost, but because, you know, you have things like sort of internal references, for example, right? So you have like, you know, a particular treaty might refer to a bunch of different other treaties, and most of the time those other treaties exist. So it seems likely that, you know, obviously a lot more of the main things were already taken to Tibet and China and translated. But yes, it could well have been the case that there were other histories and chronicles and things in Nalanda, which were lost, yeah, definitely. Mm. I mean, some of the later Tibetans were quite, had made some, Bhutan and some others made some quite good histories, but not from India. Okay, we good? Any other questions? Yes.
I'm just wondering if some things were taken to Tibet and translated, how did that place the early Buddhism? In terms of making the distinction.
In terms of what?
Like the early Buddhism, you talk about early Buddhism, yeah. And how did that relate to things that might have been taken to Tibet?
Okay, well, the Buddhism went to Tibet from about, not by no means an expert, but from about, I think, 600 or 700 AD. So roughly starting from about 1,000 years after the Buddha. And the main source of Buddhism, main source of Buddhism that went to Tibet was from Nalanda, according to the Tibetan's own story. Right? They say that they inherited the Nalanda tradition. And the Tibetan tradition was inclusive. Okay, so they tried to get as many things as possible, and they prided themselves on having a very complete collection of Buddhist scriptures. And so they collected scriptures over hundreds of years, brought them north and translated them, and they put a lot of time and effort and expertise into doing translation, so that modern reconstructions of a lot of these works are based on the Tibetan translations. However, there's a surprising gap when it comes to the early Buddhist texts. And whereas the Chinese has very complete, large collections of early suttas, in the Tibetan there's relatively small. There's no complete set of four Nikayas. And there's Dhammapadas, there's some isolated suttas here and there. There's some later treaties that quote from sutta passages and things like that. There's a reasonable amount of material there, but there's far from being a full set of four Nikayas. Yeah. So they, when in the Tibetan tradition, when they talk about what they would consider the early Buddhism, the Shravakayana and so on, they're talking about Abhidharma Buddhism. Yeah. Does that help?
I guess one thing I'm wondering is whether all of the traditions are missing something.
Are all traditions missing something?
Yeah, so they've all taken select. They've all got select.
Right. Well, this is the position that Master Yin Shun would say. He said that the Pali tradition is the representative of the first 500 years of Buddhism, the Chinese canon for the second 500 years, and the Tibetan canon for the third 500 years. So you definitely get a better understanding of the whole scope of Buddhism in India. You have to look at the whole thing. Right? Yeah, when I say you have to look at the whole thing, bear in mind nobody's ever read all of those things, right? Yeah. Yin Shun has read the whole of the Pali Nikayas and the whole of the Chinese canon a number of times. I don't think he read the whole of the Tibetan. Any other thoughts or questions, comments? No? Should we have a break first? Let's have a tea break first, and then we'll come back and get on to the creative mythology after the tea break. Seems a convenient time. All right, so types of creative mythology. Well, hang on, before we go on to this, one thing that I haven't really talked about so much, and it's an interesting topic. I won't go into so much detail, but think back to the little stick collector, Katahari, wandering through the forest and singing. What was she singing, actually? And the oldest stories and oldest mythology that we have right across the world mostly is all in verse form, and mostly have all been sung. Before we had prose stories, we had verse stories. And it's interesting that even across like very different languages and different cultures, that those verse forms tend to have similar features, like the line lengths and metrical forms and things like that tend to be quite similar. And there's something about the origin of these very oldest traditions, which you see in a very pure form in something like the Rig Veda, where they seem to spring from some form of divine inspiration. What that was exactly, who knows, right? In the Indic tradition, The god Soma was a major source of divine inspiration. Right? Because you know who the god Soma is, right?
Soma is actually an intoxicant.
My goodness, I'm saying that they were getting drunk and then going off and singing songs in poetry. Story.
The Indian,
yes.
The Indian tradition.
Yes.
Soma, S-O-M-A.
S-O-M-A, right? Oh. So that, exactly. So Soma, the exact nature of Soma is not entirely clear. Most likely a Phaedra seems to be a good candidate for it. Phaedra being kind of methamphetamine kind of thing. But, you know, maybe it might have been different things at different times, right? So anyway, so one source of divine inspiration might have been taking drugs, right? Yeah, this is where our religion come from.
Yeah.
Other forms, you know, maybe, you know, whatever kinds of rituals or practices and these kinds of things. But there's some kind of sense in which these things are felt to be not composed by personal individuals, but channeled from some kind of divine source.
I was going to say, is that why the university Buddhist Greek is called Lotus Buds?
it could be. Yeah, you have to ask them. So the, and this is the kind of thing, like the oldest mythology sort of comes from the sense of divine inspiration, and there's many different stories about this. You know, there's the the oracle at Delphi, and the stories of the origin of the Ramayana and so on. But when we come to the more modern forms of, so when we're talking about creative mythology, we're not talking about the origins of that old mythology, we're talking about the origins of the new mythology, starting with, say, something like the life of the Buddha. And let's have a look at some of the forms of this text. So I've already talked a bit about how the life of the Buddha was formed, but we're talking now more kind of in modern times how this happened. So one of the most common, most obvious forms is what we might call pious retelling of a story. A pious retelling, I'm just making these words up, so if you don't like it, that's fine, but a pious retelling is a story that the tradition tells itself. It's often maybe for children, told perhaps in a quite simplistic way. Its purpose is to keep the story alive and to pass down a sense of values, to create a sense of community, right? So it's not really sort of there to sort of provoke you or stimulate you or to, you know, engage in a kind of deep form of reflection or something like that, but more to just, you know, it has fairly kind of, you know, like you, when you go into a temple, you know, you might see like it has pictures of the Buddha's life or something like that, and, you know, it's, oh yeah, it's kind of a nice picture, but there's not too much more to it than that. It's just telling the same story again. And so this is, you know, one common form of story, which is still a creative mythology. And there can be a lot of craftsmanship in that. You know, the paintings can be done very beautifully and so on. But there's not a lot of sense of depth and meaning behind what's being done. So this is a kind of a common form of creative mythology, which you find within the tradition. So the tradition keeping those things alive. Another form of creative mythology we might call artistic adaptation. And artistic adaptation is often done by people who are not within the tradition, right? So they might not believe in it. But they're, in some sense, they're trying to recreate something about that tradition that may be lost for themselves or for others. And it's contemporary. I don't mean contemporary in the sense of like today. I mean contemporary in the sense that it responds to the time and place that adaptation is set in terms of like the methods and techniques of storytelling or the values that are expressed in it and so on. And so that's an example there of a little bit small to see it very clearly, but that's Turner's painting The Golden Bough. Which was the inspiration behind was described in the book, The Golden Bough, which I've talked about earlier. And so this depicts the grove at Nemi, where Aeneas had taken the Golden Bough and was using it as a gateway to enter the underworld. And so what Turner is doing here is he's not a devotee of ancient Roman paganism, right? He's not someone who believes that these gods are real necessarily, but it's not necessarily the case that he also kind of disbelieves them, right? I mean, he may be interested in them, and he may think that they're saying something meaningful, right? But he's trying to capture and convey some of that feeling of wonder about what's happening. And you can see, it was a little bit small to see clearly there, but you know, it's a beautiful painting in the sense that there's something kind of hazy and distant about it. There's like a sense that something significant is happening. You can almost just make out here is the Sybil who's holding up the golden bough there. And yet, you know, some people are just kind of almost like hanging around and so on. So it's kind of relaxed, easy feeling. It's not like a formal religious thing. And yet there's a sense in which it's hinting at depths which sort of lay behind it. And so this kind of thing we find a lot in the European tradition, especially, you know, through the ages, like paintings, you know, people pick up mythological motifs and paint them. I mean, a lot of times it was because it gave them an opportunity to paint naked women, and that was kind of the only excuse that they had for doing that. So people have various kind of motivations, storytelling and things like that, where these things would be taken up and retold. So this is artistic adaptation of another form of creative mythology. And of course it continues to this day. Now we have what Tolkien called sub-creation. He described his own work as being called sub-creation. And I personally am an old Tolkien fan from long ago, and I think Tolkien's work is unique and is a genre unto itself. He wasn't just retelling an old mythology, right? We draw on sources, but he wasn't just retelling an old mythology. He wasn't just sort of remixing things and imagining new things. But in a quite a deep sense, he was trying to recreate a lost mythology. Because the ancient pagan myths of England have largely been lost. And he drew upon the Norse myths, Beowulf, and other things that were available to try to create something which would be meaningful, which could be as meaningful and as rich within his English tradition as, say, the Greek myths or the Roman myths. But, of course, at the same time, it wasn't just sort of imitating or recreating mythology, because it was also very deeply personal. It was his way of dealing with the trauma that he'd experienced in wartime, in the First World War. So it was quite personal in that respect. And it was also a way of relating, because he was Catholic, right? So it was a way of relating this mythology, which he loved, to Catholicism. And if you go to the Silmarillion, you'll know that the whole mythology begins with a version of the monotheistic story and the fall of Satan and all of these kinds of things. So he actually synthesizes pagan mythology with Christian and Catholic mythology. And one of the things which you don't really kind of notice if you're like reading The Lord of the Rings or something like this is that there's no religion in The Lord of the Rings, in Tolkien's work. Curious when you think about it, isn't it? Right? There's no churches, there's no orders, there's no sacred books, there's nothing. There's no actual religion. It's kind of like an occasional allusion to Eru, the Dúvatar, the monotheistic god, or to the Valar in the West. Right? But there's no kind of formal religious practices or doctrines or anything like that. Right? And I think that the reason for that is because it isn't about a religion, it is itself a sacred text. It begins, Silmarillion begins with the act of creation and so on, and it's a version of actually telling the story, if you like, from inside religion. So it's a story of Tolkien and his personal attempt to express that story using the language of mythology of religion, and in a way the death of God. The great theme of The Lord of the Rings, of course, is again the death of God, the withdrawal of the elves are going to the west, the world is diminishing, and all of the beautiful magical things in the world are passing away. And so that kind of theme of loss and nostalgia and melancholy permeates all of his writing. And then, of course, again, it was very contemporary, right? It was reflecting what he was seeing in the English countryside around him.
So where do you go? When does the myth become a religion, and when is religion a myth?
Good question. Yeah.
All the Old Testament stories that we all grew up with, you know, Noah's Ark and all these stories, Adam and Eve and all of that stuff.
Right. When you get recognised by the tax office.
But I mean, Is it if you get enough fodder in people, if Tolkien had enough people that all believed in his story, it would be a religion rather than a
story. I mean, that's exactly what happened with that's how they founded Scientology. That's what he does, a science fiction
writer.
He decided he's going to form a religion. Yeah. That's exactly what they did.
I always look at The Last Breakfast when I was a child. Very nice, and I love it.
Which one, sorry?
The Last Breakfast, you know, with Jesus, the scene at dinner. I'm not sure.
Last Supper.
Is it? Yes. Yeah. Well, I'm not really sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm
sorry.
But he's drinking and he's last all those days drinking and binging and having womanizing. Mm. I thought, how is that a religion? And I was a little kid, I just stare at it for hours.
Right.
I always got addicted to things like that.
Yeah.
So I thought, okay, why did I put this in the book? Why is it okay to do all that and still be
And that's exactly the kind of question which in the later in some of the mythologies you find, like people actually asking, like in the Greek myths, asking Apollo, how can you be doing this? You know, you've been going around having all these children with all these women there, you're supposed to be setting a good example. That's kind of thing. So yeah.
What's the one in the census that everyone puts there?
Last.
No. Jedi. Yeah.
Oh right, yeah.
There's usually it's nearly 100,000 people.
Right, yeah.
Which is which is more than probably the number of Scientologists in the world.
but Jedi for religion.
Yeah.
That's irony.
Put it on the
But they should be really counted under Buddhism.
It began as a branch of a meditation society which developed into martial arts.
Yeah.
Very, sounds very familiar.
So this is the work of Tolkien. And to me, the thing with Tolkien is that Tolkien was a linguist and a scholar of ancient English literature, and his work was like a direct response to that mythology. And all of the fantasy writers and so on who come afterwards are responding to Tolkien. Right? And this is why I think he's like a unique generation. You can't do that anymore because we're not brought up at school and we're not studying that mythology in the original language, in the original form, to that same kind of depth. So people can refer to it and so on. But he was really coming from that. He wasn't working within a sort of a genre of modern literature. Yeah. He invented a genre of modern literature. So this is why I think that his work is really kind of pivotal. And I think it'll never be repeated. And so there's the map, famous map of Middle Earth from The Lord of the Rings, and the kind of idea that you're going to obsessively spend all this time detailing the geography, inventing languages, and all of the things that he did. Nobody had done that before.
But you may not be aware of it, Bunte, but the Game of Thrones is the one that's taken, it's clearly a direct derivative from Tolkien.
Right, yeah.
And it's also a little bit harsher than that because it's got the same sort of, conflict between the original inhabitants, if you like, or the magic and the disappearance of the magic.
Right,
And there's one, I haven't seen it, I've only read the synopsis, but there's the one character they call them the Children of the Forest.
Right.
Who were the originators of creating man.
Right.
And they also held the magic in their
So, I mean, this
Game of Thrones has been described as Lord of the Rings meets the Sopranos. You may not know who the
Sopranos.
But they're a dreadful gangster movie. And think of the two combined, a dreadful Italian New York gangsters and Lord of the Rings. And you're pretty well got throwing a few dragons.
But another thing which is also interesting, like Tolkien not only was drawing directly from the mythology, he was also drawing directly from his wartime experience, like in the trenches in the First World War.
Mordor.
And his, descriptions of like Mordor, but even in the Silmarillion, I mean, some of his stuff is like really, really dark and violent, he perhaps wasn't as explicit and so on, but a lot of it is pretty dark. Anyway, So my point here, this is a kind of creative mythology. I don't want to spend too long with Tolkien. Let's move on. So from Tolkien, then, and many others have sprung, and which we can call perhaps a fictional mythology. Star Wars being a great example, which of Game of Thrones, Harry Potter, and many others, which come out.
I think it's real though.
Well, I'm thinking as an actual. Anyway, I'm mainly looking at the things which everybody agrees are fictional, like the Avengers and the superheroes and all of those kinds of things. Now, so I mean, the history of this, perhaps you're familiar with it, but in case you're not, when around the same time that Tolkien was working, Joseph Campbell came up with his book, The Hero of a Thousand Faces, which became incredibly popular. And, you know, those two books sort of gained a long-term cultural foothold during the same period of time, right, especially through the 60s and 70s. And in the late 70s, of course, George Lucas made Star Wars, which he quite explicitly drew upon Campbell's work and the idea of the hero's journey, which was kind of modeled in Star Wars. And since then, subsequent to Star Wars and its phenomenal success, Hollywood then basically made that template for all of their blockbusters. And I can't remember the name of him, but somebody during the 80s wrote a summary, a sort of simplified summary of Campbell's hero's journey. And then that kind of circulated widely in the screenwriters and so on in Hollywood and became basically the template for writing a blockbuster. So if you're writing a blockbuster, you've got to kind of check that you've got a checklist of all the stages on the hero's journey that you've got to go through and make sure that if you miss it, you're working out. And obviously this is problematic in a lot of respects, but you can see how far we've got from that original idea of the mythology, which actually springs from, you know, a divine inspiration. It springs from real life experiences and expresses that through sort of an ecstatic poetic utterance. So these fictional mythologies, modern fictional mythologies, whether novels or films and so on, then they use Campbell's story as a template. They build some kind of lore as a backstory, so they might have languages, you know, in the Star Trek, then they have Klingon. We have a few of those on Sutta Central, so if you want to read the Metta Sutra in Klingon, we have that on Sutta Central. So there's this kind of idea about building this. So this is now all done sort of quite consciously and quite deliberately, right? And video games as well, because it's a huge effort that goes into doing all these things. Okay, now what's actually going on here? What's happening? Well, I think one of the basic idea is that because what Campbell had pointed out and what he's drawing from Jung and drawing from others, Fraser and people who came earlier, was that these stories are universal, right? You find them everywhere. And that's telling us something important about humanity, the fact that we respond to these things in some kind of meaningful way. Now, regardless of how you interpret that, like what does it actually mean, right? The reality is that, in fact, people respond to these stories. And by using this as a template, it allows modern creators to create universal stories. And if you compare these kind of mythic narratives to, say, more kind of realist narratives, where people might tell a novel based on their own life experiences, you know, and it's based on, you know, personal observation and events and these kinds of things, they tend to be much more restricted in their audience and much more restricted in their scope. Whereas these mythic narratives, which, you know, are now huge blockbusters and they're all over the world. And it's interesting because, you know, what's created through these kinds of stories is, you know, if we think of one of the early purposes of mythology is to create a community through a sharing common story. And that's still kind of what it's doing, right? I mean, you can go anywhere in the world and talk about Star Wars or Lord of the Rings or whatever the latest superhero film is, and people will connect with them. People will be wearing the T-shirts and having the action figures and all of those kinds of things. So there's some. No matter, and seeing this is the original poster for Star Wars, and apart from being a bit kind of scary, But one of the things that really kind of struck me in that kind of poster is that it's really leaning heavily on the mythological thing, right? I mean, it looks like kind of Arthur drawing the sword out of the stone or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's deliberately invoking that. In fact, Star Wars basically is a fantasy, a story set in a science fiction setting. Now, this is an example of a sort of a diagram of how the hero's journey has been kind of reduced. You know, I don't want to say this is good or bad, but I'm just sort of saying, well, it's not really the same, right? And you have to got all of these things, crossing the threshold, and then you've got these different helpers and mentors, and you've got to go down, and you've got to have like a death and rebirth scene, right? Your hero's got to die, right? And you get reborn, it's got to happen, and got to transform and atone for their sins. And so all these different kinds of things have to be part, you know, blockbuster movies and things like that. But it's also part of therapy and psychology, especially Jungian therapy relies heavily on these kinds of ideas. And one of the criticisms of these things is that it's criticized as being very masculine. It's telling a bloke story. And so this is something that we talked about a bit last week. Right, so the hero's journey is a very blokey thing, right? I'm going to leave my home, I'm going to wander off, you know, just like this guy here, into the forest, I'm going to fight these, get my sword, and I'm going to fight these people and so on. And clearly there's something a bit problematic about that, right? That we've made the template for a universal story, right, is based on a very kind of blokey story. And yes, we can then have Wonder Woman, great, and Captain Marvel, and we can get some, you know, female icons doing these things, and that's great. But it's essentially telling basically the same kind of story with a few tweaks. And so, yeah, again, I don't want to say that this is necessarily good or bad, but think about the suggestion that I made earlier that the life of the Buddha be considered as the first of an early example of the kind of the new myth or the consciously created mythology. Right? And think about the kind of similarities that there are between the life of the Buddha and, say, modern superhero movies. Right? I mean, for a start, you've got what often is a very basic, simple story, right? I mean, the story of the life of the Buddha is actually pretty simple, right? Guy living at home, got disillusioned, went to the forest, meditated, became enlightened. Right? And, of course, presented in such complicated ways. But an important part of that story is to then act as a authorization and as a... It creates significance for that community who's telling the story. In other words, the people who are telling the story are telling it for their own benefit. And again, I'm not trying to be reductive here. I'm not saying that they're only telling it for their own benefit. But, you know, you tell these great stories of the Buddha and all of these kinds of things, people are so impressed, and then you say, well, now that's going to raise some money to build a big stupa. Right? I mean, it's connected with finance and real estate and institutional authority and personal authority and all of those kinds of things. And if you have a temple that has beautiful pictures of the life of the Buddha, then that's going to draw people in, and then you can have money and prestige because of that. Right? So in a sense, the Buddhist tradition has taken an ownership of that. And that ownership depends on the fact that the Buddhist tradition has been able to marshal a lot of resources to create the story at that scale, right? So if you go to Anuradhapura and you see the incredible stupas that are there, right? I mean, this is a massive amount of resources that's been poured into that to create all the lives of the Buddha. And I think it's no coincidence that the earliest form of life of the Buddha, elaborate forms of the life of the Buddha is a book called the Lalita Vistara, which is probably a copy of here. And the Lalita Vistara is worth having a look at because it's quite astonishing in terms of of how elaborate or how decadent it is in its literary stylings. I mean, just some simple examples, like it might say, you know, when the Bodhisattva was at home in the palace and then he studied, he excelled at all of the arts and crafts, right? That's pretty straightforward, right? You might say, well, the Bodhisattva was very clever and was good at school. That's fine. But the Lalita Vistara will list for pages the different kinds of scripts that he learned, and will list for pages the different kind of languages that he learned, and for pages the different kinds of mathematics that he learned.
Yeah.
Right? And it goes on and on and on with this, and that's just one section, and then it will go to another section, and all of these things are like that. And the amount of elaboration and so on is astonishing. Right? And so it's reached a point where the storytelling style has become incredibly decadent and the human story is lost behind it. And, you know, again, compare perhaps with, say, modern, superhero movies or these kinds of things where you have so much, you know, special effects and all of the razzmatazz and things like that, that you don't have, where the humans disappear. Yeah? So this kind of idea that basically consciously created mythologies, because they're used to create an institutional mass, right? It becomes a story that authorizes an institutional mass, whether it be fundraising for a monastery or whether it be profits for Disney, right? Then that story, the ownership of the story, the very scale of that story is what keeps the ownership of it doing that big thing, because small monasteries can't afford to do that, right? And so it becomes self-perpetuating. And so the decadence of those stories is something, and is something that, it's a pattern which is established from those early times. And again, I think it's no coincidence that the Lalita Vistara is one of the key texts which Joseph Campbell cites in the hero of a thousand faces. Right? In almost every one of the stages of the hero's journey, he's citing from the Lalita Vistara as one of his key texts. And that is the one which ultimately is taken up. And there's a very direct connection between these things, what's been happening in the past with Buddhism and what's happening in the present with creative mythology and so on.
Wondering what do you think the point of the additional verbiage is? Because
it's to overwhelm.
Make story big.
Yeah, it's like an overwhelming spectacle, right?
It can.
It just becomes bigger and it becomes more, and as it becomes...
Oh. May I ask, it occurs to me that most of the hero stories I know begin with a child of sorrow.
Absolutely, yeah. Mm. One of the stock the motifs in the hero's journey,
the child and the child of sorrow.
Yeah.
Arthur, the orphan.
Yeah.
Of course, Star Wars.
The Buddha, his mother passed away.
His mother died. And,
yeah.
Yes, is it? Yes, and of course, yeah.
Jesus.
Child of sorrow.
Yeah, born in a manger.
Well, they were refugees.
Yeah, they were going around trying to kill them all, right?
Obviously, a sharp parentage. And,
how dare you!
And Herod was trying to kill them all, right?
Yes.
And
the refugees.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So, but yes, this is one of the classic motifs. Like, again, it comes back to that idea of, like, being in between everything. You know, so like the Buddha was born halfway between his father's home and his mother's home.
Mm. Ah, yes.
Mm. In the forest.
Yes.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, so you're, like, suspended, right? So then when you're in that state of suspension, then you have possibility.
A bit weird. In Sri Lanka, we don't hear much about the Lalita Vistara.
No,
it's Indonesia, right? It's usually in Indonesia that inscribed.
Exactly, yeah. It was for Borobudur, yeah.
Borobudur, so it's more the Sanskrit.
It was northern Sanskrit. Yeah. It was extremely popular.
Yeah.
It's mentioned a lot, and, you know, it's also it is the root text for Borobudur. Yeah.
Is there anything to do with in between with the middle way or the section?
Well, I think so, yeah.
What is
it? Well, it's the same kind of idea, right? That the, you know, avoiding the two extremes. Yeah.
Yeah, I also say that the child, the impression was lost. It's lost in the forest.
It has to find something.
The child, Moses and the bulrushes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The child is lost and found crying in the wilderness.
Yeah.
And his hero's journey
Is it the same thing as in Dante's Inferno?
Oh, I don't know.
No.
Well, he's maybe doing the abyss, death, and return part. The abyss and return part.
Dante's Inferno is essentially about a really bad drunk. Myself in the middle part of my life getting once into a fix.
Yes.
And therein drinking kind of hits people and the ghosts and things. So it's a really big bad drunk.
Right. Well, then we'll do the same with
you would say, broadly speaking, a person with a lot of refinements. Having found myself in the middle.
Yeah, a lot of doubts.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dante's Inferno was a resolution of doubt. That's my, and I'm very, very familiar with it. I think I read it once, but I just can't remember very much of it other than that. It was just a rather awful dream, subsequent upon a person getting very lost. And
in search of his beloved Beatrice.
Yes, of course.
What you were just saying about the story from Greg Egan, the humans have disappeared. I won't comment that way. What I was going to ask was, could you look at the way Buddhism spread and other religions have spread around the world as having that modern story to tell when they get to areas that have maybe not been
right,
a modern.
Absolutely, yeah. And again, in the same way that Hollywood does it. Same thing, right? Because you're telling a story that invokes these universal archetypes.
Yeah.
Then when you get to a new country, you can tell the story and people can relate to it.
And then they leave their older story, but they're more influenced by the new story.
And the old, but they don't necessarily leave the old story, but the old story becomes incorporated.
Yeah. So like Timor Islands having Christianity.
Yeah. But again, that same kind of thing, right? That's why Hollywood's been able to sell movies all around the world. Because they sell, it's all based on these universal ideas. It's not based on like specifics of culture.
Probably a question I haven't realised I've had before about, well, why do these countries adopt the new thing so readily? What was missing in their old thing? And of course you could say, well, the Buddha's teachings were missing, but it's also how they test them.
Campbell's point on the spiritual birth is the virgin birth.
Uh-huh.
So the hero's journey is about having to have that virgin birth, because the hero, at the end of the journey, is then reborn as their true self.
Right.
And that's done through their own journey, not through. Yeah.
Okay. So just hoping to get to the end of the slides by the thing. So in the discussion last week, I suggested that the Beauty and the Beast story type, which is an equivalent, like a female equivalent of the masculine hero myth, and this idea was from Marina Warner and others who have written on this. And so this, the Dohala story, which I've spoken of in previous sessions, is related to this, not exactly the same, but it's related to this idea, and the general idea behind this group of stories is that the woman who wins her battles at home rather than going out into the forest. And so a suggestion that I'm making here is that the most obvious modern genre that draws upon this story is the genre not of fantasy or superheroes, but of horror. Because in horror stories, horror books and horror films and things like that, it's usually about what happens in the home, right? And it's usually about the final girl, right? Who's the one who survives. And rather than a masculine hero going out into the world and winning some kind of power or something like that, And her gift, her superpower, is just that she's living at the end of it. And that idea in horror is that the most horrifying sentence, yeah, is when you realize it's coming from inside the house. Yeah. And so it's about a woman's facing up to the dangers and the threats in the home, whether literal threats in terms of domestic violence and so on, or in terms of childbirth and other threats which she has to overcome. I mean, this is very obvious in some cases, like, say, Bluebeard, which is obviously a horror tale, right? And it's obviously a direct antecedent of the...
Are you familiar with the series called Alien? I'm not sure.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Took Rose.
Yeah.
You're not familiar with
it? Yeah, of course, yes.
That's very
in
much...
In space, no one can hear you scream.
Sorry?
In space, no one can hear you scream.
That's
no
one can hear you scream.
And, of course, the female hero, yeah. Yeah, and very feminine imagery through that.
The villain's a female too.
Yes, the,
right, yeah, both the villain and the hero, isn't it? Yeah, exactly. So,
does Alice in Wonderland fit into this?
Yeah,
Alice in Wonderland.
Fairy tales and Little Red Riding Hood.
Little Red Riding Hood definitely fair. I mean, Alice in Wonderland that's just a trip, aren't they? maybe. I guess so. I haven't thought about it. Yeah. But a Little Red Riding Hood, definitely, right?
What
big ears you have.
The story has got a moral, more black and white in those fairy tale style stories.
And they're often very horrific.
Yeah,
very gory. So the point here I'm trying to make here is that sometimes, like, if we think about, like, modern mythology, you know, something like, say, The Lord of the Rings or whatever, Game of Thrones or something, it's fairly obvious that this is drawing on mythology and that's what we think of. But my point is that these mythic archetypes and ideas are inherited more broadly in different kind of genres and storytelling, and they influence them in ways that might be unexpected. And so particularly that idea that once we notice that kind of woman's story, the story of overcoming the monster in the home, then we begin to realize that actually has influences and expressions in the modern day that relate to the women's storytelling, which was happening from the past. And so I want to lead up to some thoughts about where this is leading and what we're going to be thinking now. So the current era, now the scientists use the term the Anthropocene, meaning the era where nature has been replaced, or that nature is, there's basically nowhere you can go in nature that's not under the influence of human activity. And whether it's in the bottom of the deepest trenches in the ocean, or on the top of the Himalayan mountains, or at the South Pole, or as we were just a few weeks ago in Central Australia, where the landscape is, you know, no matter how remote you are, the landscape is completely altered by human activity, not just through the more gentle Aboriginal husbandry of the land for thousands of years, but even in the last few tens of years, the landscape has massively changed according to the people who are living on the land. And when you go to somewhere like that, it's so remote, and, you know, you're talking to someone who says, like, you know, 20 years ago, it was so different. And you think, are you kidding? And when you go there, it looks like a timeless, eternal landscape. And he says, no, there used to be so much more wildflowers, and there used to be so much different kinds of animals, and they're all gone now. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And so this is what we mean when we're talking about the Anthropocene, is we're living in an era that's defined by human activity. The oldest hero myth of Gilgamesh and Enkidu, overcame the primordial beast Humbaba, and they felled the cedar to build their cities. This is the cedar in Lebanon. So that's the oldest of the great myths that we have. That's the point of it, to cut down the forest. Yeah. Now, the heroes are gone. They've conquered nature and we live in their world. And in many ways, that idea of nature doesn't really exist anymore. I mean, yeah, of course, to some extent it does, right? I mean, if you get whatever airlifted into the Amazon basin or something, it's still going to be fairly primordial, right? But for most of the time, the sort of nature is being reduced to Instagram posts and, you know, it's not this primordial unknown anymore. It doesn't exist. And what are we conquering, right? I mean, these days, if you see, like someone like Gilgamesh, you know, he was depicted with a, we saw his image last week with the holding the tigers that he had killed, right? Mm-hmm. And in those days, that's an image of like an awesome hero, right? That has wrestled with tigers and won. He's like one tiger in either hand. Like,
okay. And it's like climbing up Everest.
Right, climbing Everest and nothing. But of course, if you see that today, it's like to be like, you know, one of the Trump sons or something like that, you know, and it's a sign of a lot of heroes and it's a sign of being a complete asshole. So, what does that hero myth mean? Like, what have we got to conquer, right? I mean, maybe space, okay, but what actually role does that hero myth come? What would mean it anymore? If there's no more wilderness, no more monsters to battle out there, then the whole world is our home. Perhaps the story we need is of the one who finds a way to survive and to flourish at home in nature. So there is no outside anymore. There's only our home. And this whole world is our home. And those stories that we've seen, especially the Dalhalla stories, the story of Kena, the purpose of those stories is not to win a battle, not to gain a kingship, it's not to find a treasure, it's to create a covenant, it's to create compassion, it's to create an agreement and an understanding between humanity and nature that's going to allow for a mutual flourishing, because it is our home. And in those stories, this is very literal. Kema, the heroine of those stories, that the princess or the queen whose wish makes the story possible and whose wish makes it possible for the hero to go on his journey. Yeah? Her name is literally the name of the lake that the geese come to stay in. Her name, Kema, is the sanctuary, yeah? And she is literally identified with that sanctuary. And so that story, the story of someone who lives, I think maybe we need to be putting a little bit more focus on that story rather than focusing on the story of the one who conquers.
And Bhante, even here we're talking about in nature, that the great unknown is our own consciousness.
Well, speak for yourself. But sure, fair enough, yes, of course, yeah.
Just to bring it back home, you
right.
know, is the most valuable, because that's what he showed.
Right.
It was that journey, you know, there's the nature out there, but there's
right.
the great
And I didn't go into that too much, but it's also, it is interesting that you know, I mentioned before that the when Giles asked this question about the Bodhisattva makes his choice to leave home, right? So he has a choice between staying with his family or going and leaving home, right? And I said that nexus is negotiated in different ways, right? Now, some of the ways that is negotiated is that those who stay home, specifically Yashodhara, then echo the Buddha's own journey, and they find their own enlightenment while staying in the home as he does by going into the forest. Yeah? So this again is an interesting kind of reflection of that if we're thinking of the story as a reflection of an inner journey, you know, we're used to hearing that told in terms of the hero myth, right? But it can also be told in terms of that inner myth, or that myth of staying home as well.
Maybe it's a bit like religion, we need a new myth, because you know, the myth has a social function in it, in terms of the way society would become structured.
Absolutely.
And what people would focus on.
Yeah.
And so those myths no longer work for us in such a technological age.
Exactly. So we create those. And so we create story to give ourselves meaning. And if we, you know, this is one of the reasons why I think, like an overly rationalistic, an overly sort of secularist approach to religion doesn't really work, because you dismiss all of the myths and say, well, that's not real, therefore I'm not going to bother paying attention to it. And then you lose that sense of kind of wonder.
Yeah.
So, but I agree, you know, it's one of the things that, you know, I'm interested in doing, you know, and I wanted to sort of raise that question and for people to think about, like, what would we, as people who are interested in following the Buddha's path, you know, what kind of creative response would we like to do with myth? And, you know, as I mentioned before, there are those different kinds of creative mythology, and they all have their place, right? And, you know, there's a place for getting some kids and getting them to do a colouring in book where they're colouring the picture of the life of the Buddha or something like that, right? And that's a part of that. But I think to think about meaningful ways that we can re-express these stories today, I think it's an interesting challenge. I mean, this is something I've probably talked about far too often, but my own idea is I want to do a cyberpunk life of the Buddha, but I haven't done it yet, so I've only just started, so this is something, when I get some time, I got sidetracked by translating the Four Nikayas and stuff like that, so when I get that out of the way, then that's what I'd like to do.
You did a lot of material to work with, didn't
you? Sure, yeah.
My own personal experience, actually, my whole interest in spirituality comes from The Empire Strikes Back.
Okay. Specifically, The Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah.
Because of Yoda,
that's when I started going, oh, something in this.
Right.
I was 14 or something.
Yeah.
I was fascinated.
And of course, Yoda modeled explicitly after a Buddhist monk.
Yeah. It was one of George Lucas's.
More shallow.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, when you mentioned the Kema, the sanctuary story, that was really beautiful, I think, what you said at the end. It kind of was almost like struck the bell at my heart, you know, because I just feel that what brought up, we had these sanctuaries and trees and all these things that were the beginning of human spirituality. And it's just all being destroyed, and until we come to see the whole earth as sacred and what we've got left of the nature, you know, it's a changing love of the human images and, you know, copies of the nature. They are valued more than the nature. You know, the pictures of the trees, look, millions of dollars are paid for that. And, you know, it just, you know, I'm just saying what I see.
It's
a shift of turning it upside down, the value system, you know. What do you value more? Human creation, the pictures, the reflections in the water, or the light?
Mm.
A lot of folk stories are protecting nature. They're all around the water pools. The fairies in Ireland are all the water fairies around the pools. We're sharing water, the values and sharing water. Aboriginal stories, perhaps, as well.
Yeah, of course, yeah. Always very important in the story.
Yeah, so it's catching nature. Different stories survive, you know, so the epics, maybe it needs to be an epic to survive, or, you know, obviously a good romantic tragedy or a comedy. There's different sort of stories will survive. I mean, maybe we're seeing the conspiracy theorists are competing more and more epic. You know, so they've got the aliens, the kind of lizards to contend with.
Right, yeah. I mean, a story which a few years ago you would have been thinking that's ridiculous, and now you're starting to think,
the bigger and bigger asset wins.
Becoming more plausible with every passing year. Okay, great. So look, we should probably wrap up now, and at 9 o'clock, I wanted to say thank you so much to everybody for coming along. Thank you so much for your participation and your attention. It's been a delight and a joy to share these stories with you and to share my own thoughts and reflections with you. I hope that you take this away, and I hope that it will enrich your own encounters with story, both Buddhist and other story, and will prompt you to start questioning and start looking at these things in a hopefully richer way. And just to plug once more, white bones, red rock, black snakes, that's got all of the stories in it pretty much, we told. So just Google that and you should be able to download it and either download it as a PDF or order the book. And that's my magnum opus right there. And this is the final of the Buddhism and Mythology course, and we also finished off the Sutta class on Sunday. So this is the last talk that I'll be giving at Buddhist Library. It's part of the regular structured courses and so on that we have at the moment. So I just want to express once more my gratitude and appreciation to the Buddhist Library and to all of the staff and volunteers here for their gracious and very dedicated and kind work making this space available for everybody, and the trustees as well, because they do their bit as well. And not as much, but they do a little bit, yeah. And so in the coming months, we will be doing, we'll be coming to the Rains Retreat soon, but during the Rains Retreat, I will be doing teachings every Friday night at the Harris Park Community Centre. That will be continuing, and it will be continuing indefinitely. So please, any Friday night, the Harris Park Community Centre, please come along. And during the Rains Retreat, we're also doing a series of six sutta workshops, day-long sutta and meditation workshops in Parramatta. So you can check our website for the details of that or ask Deepika about that. So there's 6 days and you can come along and do the day of practice and reflection where we're going through the Dhammapada. Next week is the Sakyajita conference, so I'll be there. Hopefully if some of you are there, then I'll see you there. Dhamma Threads, are we going to advertise Dhamma Threads, or are we going to be too
full? We have a full house.
We have a full house, okay. And
it's a small house, though. A small place.
A small place, yeah. Anything else? I think that we're good. And also, just to let you know that what we're doing at Harris Park is we have just a small flat there, and we're having to pay rent, so if anybody wants to give a donation to help out with the rent there, then that's most appreciated. And myself and Venerable Calico have been there for a while. We're very happy, and so we're going to be staying there for the time being. Okay. That's it. Anything else?